Oshet Audio presents Lone Survivor, the eyewitness account of Operation Red Wing and the lost heroes of SEAL Team 10. Written by Marcus Luttrell with Patrick Robinson. Read by Kevin T. Collins.
This book is dedicated to the memory of Murph, Axe, and Danny Boy, Christensen, Shane, James, Sr., Jeff, Jacques, Taylor, and Mac. These were the 11 men of Alpha and Echo platoons who fought and died in the mountains of Afghanistan trying to save my life, and with whom I was honored to serve my country. There is no waking hour when I do not remember them all with the deepest affection and the most profound, heartbreaking sadness. That second operation in Afghanistan, the snatch and grab of Abdul the Bomb Maker, or whatever the hell his name was, brought home two aspects of this conflict to us newly arrived SEALs. First, the rabid hatred these Muslim extremists had for all of us. Second, the awkwardness of complying with our rules of engagement, ROE, in this type of warfare. SEALs, by our nature, training, and education, are not very stupid, and along with everyone else, we read the newspaper headlines from all over the world about serving members of the armed forces who have been charged with murder in civilian courts for doing what they thought was their duty, attacking their enemy. Our rules of engagement in Afghanistan specified that we could not shoot, kill, or injure unarmed civilians. But what about the unarmed civilian who was a skilled spy for the illegal forces we were trying to remove? What about an entire secret army, diverse, fragmented, and lethal, creeping through the mountains in Afghanistan, pretending to be civilians? What about those guys? How about the innocent-looking camel drovers making their way through the mountain passes with enough high explosives strapped to the backs of their beasts to blow up Yankee Stadium? How about those guys? We all knew that we'd chosen to do what 999 Americans out of every 1,000 would not even think about doing. And we were taught that we were necessary for the security of our nation. We were sent to Afghanistan to carry out hugely dangerous missions, but we were also told that we could not shoot that camel drover before he blew up all of us, because he might be an unarmed civilian just taking his dynamite for a walk. And how about his buddy, the younger guy with the stick running along behind, prodding the freaking camels? How about him? How about if he can't wait to scamper up those mountains and find his brother and the rest of the Taliban hard men, the ones with the RPGs waiting in the hidden cave? We wouldn't hear him reveal our position, and neither would the politicians who drafted those ROEs. And those men in suits won't be on that mountainside when the first grenade explodes among us and takes off someone's leg or head. Should we have shot that little son of a gun right off the bat, before he had a chance to run? Or was he just an unarmed civilian, doing no harm to anyone, just taking his TNT for a walk, right? These terrorist insurgents know the rules as well as they did in Iraq. They're not their rules. They're our rules, the rules of the Western countries, the civilized side of the world. And every terrorist knows how to manipulate them in their own favor. Otherwise, the camel drovers would be carrying guns. But they don't, because they know we are probably scared to shoot them, because we might get charged with murder, which I actually know they consider to be on the hysterical side of laughable. And if we did shoot a couple of them, They would be on their cell phones with the speed of 10,000 gigabytes direct to the Arab television station Al Jazeera. Brutal U.S. troops gunned down peace-loving Afghan farmers. U.S. military promises SEALs will be charged. Well, something like that. I'm sure you get my drift. The media in the United States of America would crucify us. These days, they always do. Was there ever a greater uproar than the one that broke out over Abu Ghraib? In the bigger scheme of things, in the context of all the death and destruction that Muslim extremists have visited upon this world, a bunch of Iraqi prisoners being humiliated does not ring my personal alarm bell. And it would not ring yours either if you ever saw firsthand what these guys are capable of. I mean, Jesus. They cut off people's heads, American heads, aid workers' heads. They think nothing of slaughtering thousands of people. They've stabbed and mutilated young American soldiers. Like something out of the Middle Ages. The truth is, in this kind of terrorist insurgent warfare, no one can tell who's a civilian and who's not. So what's the point of framing rules that cannot be comprehensively carried out by anyone? Rules that are unworkable, because half the time, no one knows who the goddamned enemy is, and by the time you find out, it might be too late to save your own life. Making sense of the ROEs in real-time situations is almost impossible. Also, no one seems clear on what we should be called in Afghanistan. Are we a peacekeeping force? Are we fighting a war against insurgents on behalf of the Afghan government? Or are we fighting it on behalf of the USA? Are we trying to hunt down the master terrorist bin Laden? Or are we just trying to prevent the Taliban from regaining control of the country? Because they were the protectors of bin Laden and all who fought for him. Search me. But everything's cool with us. Tell us what you want, and we'll do it. We're loyal servants of the U.S. government. But Afghanistan involves fighting behind enemy lines. Never mind we were invited into a democratic country by its own government. Never mind there's no shooting across the border in Pakistan, the illegality of the Taliban army, the Geneva Convention, yada, yada, yada. When we're patrolling those mountains, trying everything we know to stop the Taliban regrouping, striving to find and arrest the top commanders and explosive experts, we are always surrounded by a well-armed, hostile enemy whose avowed intention is to kill us all. That's behind enemy lines. Trust me. And we'll go there, all day, every day. We'll do what we're supposed to do, to the letter, or die in the attempt. On behalf of the USA, but don't tell us who we can attack. That ought to be up to us, the military, and if the liberal media and political community cannot accept that sometimes the wrong people get killed in war, then I can only suggest they first grow up and then serve a short stint up in the Hindu Kush. They probably would not survive. The truth is, any government that thinks war is somehow fair and subject to rules like a baseball game probably should not get into one, because nothing's fair in war, and occasionally the wrong people do get killed. It's been happening for about 1 million years. Faced with the murderous cutthroats of the Taliban, we are not fighting under the rules of Geneva 4, Article 4. We are fighting under the rules of Article 223.556mm. That's the caliber and bullet gauge of our M4 rifle. And if those numbers don't look good, try Article 762mm. That's what the stolen Russian Kalashnikovs fire at us, usually in deadly, heavy volleys. In the global war on terror, we have rules, and our opponents use them against us. We try to be reasonable. They will stop at nothing. They will stoop to any form of base warfare. Torture, beheading, mutilation, attacks on innocent civilians, women and children, car bombs, suicide bombers, anything the hell they can think of. They're right up there with the monsters of history. And I ask myself, who's prepared to go furthest to win this war? Answer, they are. They'll willingly die to get their enemy. They will take it to the limit, anytime, any place, whatever it takes, and they don't have rules of engagement. Thus, we have an extra element of fear and danger when we go into combat against the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, the fear of our own, the fear of what our own Navy Judge Advocate General might rule against us, the fear of the American media and their unfortunate effect on American politicians. We all harbor fears about untrained, half-educated journalists who only want a good story to justify their salaries and expense accounts. Don't think it's just me. We all detest them, partly for their lack of judgment, mostly because of their ignorance and toe-curling opportunism. The first minute an armed conflict turns into a media war, the news becomes someone's opinion, not hard truths. When the media gets involved in the United States, that's a war you've got a damned good chance of losing, because the restrictions on us are immediately amplified, and that's sensationally good news for our enemy. Every now and then, a news reporter or a photographer gets in the way sufficiently to stop a bullet. And without missing a beat, those highly paid news people become national heroes, lauded back home in the press and on television. SEALs are not churlish, but I cannot describe how irksome this is to the highly trained but not very well paid guys who are doing the actual fighting. These are superb professionals who say nothing and place themselves in harm's way every day, too often being killed or wounded. They are silent heroes, unknown soldiers, except in equally unknown, heartbroken little home communities. We did one early mission up there in the passes at Checkpoint 6 that was worse than lethal. We just managed to get into position, about 20 of us, when these Afghan wild men hidden in the mountains unleashed a barrage of rockets at us. Hundreds and hundreds of them, flying over our heads, slamming into the mountainside. We couldn't tell whether they were classified as armed combatants against the United States or unarmed civilians. It took us 3 days to subdue them. And even then, we had to call in heavy air support to enable us to get out. 3 days later, the satellite pictures showed us the Taliban had sent in 12 cutthroats by night, armed with Kalashnikovs and tribal knives, who crept through the darkness, intent on murder, directly to our old position. But you can't prove their intentions, I hear the liberals squeal. No, of course not. They were just headed up there for a cup of coffee. Those Taliban night attacks were the very same tactics the Mujahideen used against the Russians, sliding through the darkness and cutting the throats of guards and sentries until the Soviet military and the parents of young soldiers could stand it no more. The Mujahideen has now emerged as the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and their intentions against us are just as bloodthirsty as they were against the Russians. The Navy SEALs can deal with that, as we can deal with any enemy. But not if someone wants to put us in jail for it back home in the USA. And we sure as hell don't want to hang around in the mountains waiting for someone to cut our throats, unable to fight back just in case he might be classified as an unarmed Afghan farmer. But these are the problems of the modern U.S. combat soldier, the constant worry about overstepping the mark, and an American media that delights in trying to knock us down, which we have done nothing to deserve, except, perhaps, love our country and everything it stands for. Danny and I waited, and the sun climbed high over the peaks and began to dry our wet clothes. The others came back after maybe an hour, and Mikey said they had found an excellent place for observing the village, but that cover was sparse. I think he considered there would be some heightened risk in this operation no matter what because of the terrain. But if we did not take that risk, we'd likely be up here till Christmas. And once more, we all hoisted our packs and set off to the new hiding place. It was only about 1,000 yards, but it took us an hour moving along and then up the mountain right on to that granite finger at the end of the ridge. And when we got there, I had to agree, it was perfect, offering a brilliant angle on the village for the lens, the spotting scope, and the bullet. It had sensational all-around vision. If Sharmack and his gang of villains were there, we'd get him. As Mikey observed, that guy couldn't get to the goddamned communal shitter without us seeing him. Danny's reply was not suitable for a family story such as this, entailing as it did the possible blasting of one of Sharmack's principal working parts. I stood there gazing at our new mountain stronghold with its massive, sheer drops all around. It was perfect, but it was also highly dangerous. If an attacking force came up on us, especially at night, we'd have no choice but to fight our way out. If someone started firing RPGs at us, we'd all be blown to pieces. There was only one way out, the way we had come. A skilled strategist like Sharmack could have blockaded us out here on this barren, stony point, and we'd have needed to kill a lot of guys to get out. And there was the ever-present, disquieting thought that Sharmack's buddy Bin Laden might also be in the area, with probably the biggest Al-Qaeda force we'd ever faced. But, in its way, this place was perfect, with the most commanding views any surveillance team could wish for. We just somehow had to burrow into this loose, rocky shale, keep our heads down, stay camouflaged, and concentrate. We'd be okay as long as no one saw us, but I still had a very uneasy feeling. So did the others. We all had something to eat, more water, and then we lay there face down, quietly steaming as the sun dried our clothes. It was now hotter than hell, and I was lying under a felled log, jammed into the curve right against the wood, my feet out behind me. But unhappily, I was on top of a stinging nettle that was driving me mad. I could not, of course, move one muscle. Who knew if a pair of long-range binoculars was trained on us at this very moment? I was on glass, silently using the scope and binos. Murph was 50 yards away, positioned higher than me among some rocks. Axe was to my right, perched in an old tree stump hollow. Danny was down to the left in the last of the trees with the radio, hunkered down, the only one of us with any shade from the burning sun. It was approaching noon, and the sun was directly in the south, high, really high, almost straight above us. We could not be seen from below, and there was definitely no human being level with or above us, at least not on this Seal's Mountain. We only had to wait. Stay very still, shut up, and concentrate. Four disciplines at which we were all expert. It was deathly quiet up there, just as silent as the night, and the silence was broken only by the occasional terse exchange between one seal and another, usually aimed toward Danny's privileged position in the shade, out of the direct rays of the sweltering mountain sun. They were not particularly professional exchanges either, lacking grace and understanding. "Hey, Danny, wanna switch places?" "Fuck you." That type of thing. Nothing else. Not another sound to drift into the mountain air. But suddenly, I did hear a sound, which carried directly to the southwest side of my felled tree. The unmistakable noise of soft footsteps right above me. Jesus Christ, I was lucky I didn't need to change my pants. And just as suddenly, there was a guy wearing a turban and carrying a fucking axe. He jumped off the log right over the top of me. I damn near fainted with shock. I just wasn't expecting it. I wheeled around, grabbed my rifle, and pointed it straight at him, which I considered might at least discourage him from beheading me. He was plainly more startled than I was, and he dropped the axe. And then I saw the other axe standing up and aiming his rifle right at the guy's turban. "You must have seen him," I snapped at him. "Why the hell didn't you tell me? He nearly gave me a heart attack."
"Just didn't want to make any noise," said Axe. "I drew a bead on him and kept him in my sights until he reached your log. One false move, I'd have killed him right there."
I told the guy to sit down against the log. And then something ridiculous happened. About 100 goats, all with little bells around their necks, came trotting up the mountain, swarming all around the spot where we were now standing. Then, up over the hill, came two more guys. All of us were now surrounded by goats, and I motioned for them to join their colleague on the ground against the log. That's the Afghans, not the goats. Finally, Mikey and Danny made their way up through the bleeding herd and saw immediately what was going on. Like me, they noted that one of the three was just a kid, around 14 years old. I tried to ask them if they were Taliban, and they all shook their heads, the older men saying in English,
"No Taliban, no Taliban."
I gave the kid one of my power bars, and he scowled at me, just put it down on a rock next to him with no thanks or nod of appreciation. The two adults glared at us, making it obvious they disliked us intensely. Of course, they were probably wondering what the hell we were doing wandering about their farm with enough weapons and ammunition to conquer an entire Afghan province. The question was, what did we do now? They were very obviously goat herds, farmers from the high country, or, as it states in the pages of the Geneva Convention, unarmed civilians. The strictly correct military decision would still be to kill them without further discussion, because we could not know their intentions. How could we know if they were affiliated with a Taliban militia group or sworn by some tribal blood pact to inform the Taliban leaders of anything suspicious looking they found in the mountains? And oh boy, were we suspicious looking. The hard fact was, if these three Afghan scarecrows ran off to find Sharmak and his men, we were going to be in serious trouble, trapped out here on this mountain ridge. The military decision was clear. These guys could not leave there alive. I just stood there, looking at their filthy beards, rough skin, gnarled hands, and hard, angry faces. These guys did not like us. They showed no aggression, but neither did they offer or want the hand of friendship. Axelson was our resident academic as well as our Trivial Pursuit king, and Mikey asked him what he considered we should do.
"I think we should kill them, because we can't let them go," he replied with the pure, simple logic of the born intellect. "And you, Danny?"
"I don't really give a shit what we do," he said. "You want me to kill him? I'll kill him. Just give me the word. I only work here."
"Marcus?"
"Well, until right now, I'd assumed killing him was our only option. I'd like to hear what you think, Murph."
Mikey was thoughtful.
"Listen, Marcus, if we kill them,
Someone will find their bodies real quick. For a start, these fucking goats are just gonna hang around, and when these guys don't get home for their dinner, their friends and relatives are going to head straight out to look for them, especially for this 14-year-old. The main problem is the goats, because they can't be hidden, and that's where people will look. When they find the bodies, the Taliban leaders will sing to the Afghan media. The media in the USA will latch on to it and write stuff about the brutish U.S. armed forces. Very shortly after that, we'll be charged with murder. The murder of innocent, unarmed Afghan farmers. I had to admit, I had not really thought about it quite like that. But there was a terrible reality about Mikey's words. Was I afraid of these guys? No. Was I afraid of their possible buddies in the Taliban? No. Was I afraid of the liberal media back in the USA? Yes. And I suddenly flashed on the prospect of many, many years in a U.S. civilian jail alongside murderers and rapists. And yet, as a highly trained member of the U.S. Special Forces, deep in my warrior's soul, I knew it was nuts to let these goat herds go. I tried to imagine what the great military figures of the past would have done. Napoleon, Patton, Omar Bradley, MacArthur. Would they have made the ice-cold military decision to execute these cats because they posed a clear and present danger to their men? If these Afghans blew the whistle on us, we might all be killed. Right out here on this rocky, burning-hot promontory, thousands and thousands of miles from home, light-years from help. The potential force against us was too great. To let these guys go on their way was military suicide. All we knew was Sharmack had between 80 and 200 armed men. I remember taking the middle number, 140, and asking myself how I liked the odds of 140 to 4. That's 35 to 1. Not much. I looked at Mikey and told him, "Murph, we gotta get some advice." We both turned to Danny, who had fired up the comms system and was valiantly trying to get through to HQ. We could see him becoming very frustrated, like all comms operators do when they cannot get a connection. He kept trying, and we were rapidly coming to the conclusion the goddamned radio was up the creek. "That thing need new batteries?" I asked him. "No, it's fine, but they won't fucking answer me." The minutes went by. The goat herds sat still, Axe and Murph with their rifles aimed straight at them, Danny acting like he could have thrown the comm system over the goddamned cliff. "They won't answer," he said through gritted teeth. "I don't know why. It's like no one's there." "There must be someone there," said Murph, and I could hear the anxiety in his voice. "Well, there isn't," said Danny. "Murphy's god-awful law," I said. "Not you, Mikey, that other prick, the god of screw-ups." No one laughed, not even me, and the dull realization dawned on us. We were on our own and had to make our own decision. Mike Murphy said quietly, "We've got three options. We plainly don't want to shoot these guys because of the noise. So number one, we could just kill them quietly and hurl the bodies over the edge. That's probably a 1,000-foot drop. Number two is we kill them right here, cover them up as best we can with rocks and dirt. Either way, we get the hell out and say nothing. Not even when the story comes out about the murdered Afghan goat herds. And some fucking headline back home which reads, 'Navy SEALs under suspicion.' Number three, we turn them loose and still get the hell out in case the Taliban come looking." He stared at us. I can remember it just like it was yesterday. Axe said firmly, "We're not murderers, no matter what we do. We're on active duty behind enemy lines, sent here by our senior commanders. We have a right to do everything we can to save our own lives. The military decision is obvious. To turn them loose would be wrong. If this came to a vote, as it might, Axe was going to recommend the execution of the three Afghans. And in my soul, I knew he was right. We could not possibly turn them loose. But my trouble is, I have another soul. My Christian soul. And it was crowding in on me. Something kept whispering in the back of my mind it would be wrong to execute these unarmed men in cold blood. And the idea of doing that and then covering our tracks and slinking away like criminals, denying everything, would make it more wrong. To be honest, I'd have been happier to stand them up and shoot them right out in front and then leave them. They'd just be three guys who'd found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time, casualties of war. And we'd just have to defend ourselves when our own media and politicians back in the USA tried to hang us on a murder charge. None of us liked the sneaky options. I could tell that. I guess all four of us were Christians. And if we were thinking like ordinary law-abiding U.S. citizens, we would find it very hard to carry out the imperative military decision, the overriding one, the decision any great commander would have made. These guys can never leave this place alive. The possible consequences of that were unacceptable, militarily. Lieutenant Murphy said, "Axe, no choice." We all knew what he meant. "Danny? As before, I don't give a shit what you decide. Just tell me what to do." "Marcus?" "I don't know, Mikey." "Well, let me tell you one more time. If we kill these guys, we have to be straight about it. Report what we did. We can't sneak around this. Just so you all understand, their bodies will be found. The Taliban will use it to the max. They'll get it in the papers, and the U.S. liberal media will attack us without mercy. We will almost certainly be charged with murder. I don't know how you guys feel about that. Marcus, I'll go with you. Call it." I just stood there. I looked again at these sullen Afghan farmers. Not one of them tried to say a word to us. They didn't need to. Their glowering stares said plenty. We didn't have rope to bind them. Tying them up to give us more time to establish a new position wasn't an option. I looked Mikey right in the eye, and I said, "We gotta let him go." It was the stupidest, most southern-fried, lame-brained decision I ever made in my life. I must have been out of my mind. I had actually cast a vote which I knew could sign our death warrant. I'd turned into a fucking liberal, a half-assed, no-logic nitwit, all heart, no brain, and the judgment of a jackrabbit. At least, that's how I look back on those moments now. Probably not then, but for nearly every waking hour of my life since. No night passes when I don't wake in a cold sweat thinking of those moments on that mountain. I'll never get over it. I cannot get over it. The deciding vote was mine, and it will haunt me till they rest me in an East Texas grave. Mikey nodded. "Okay," he said. "I guess that's 2-1. Danny abstains. We gotta let him go." I remember no one said anything. We could just hear the short staccato sounds of the goats, baa, 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 and the tinkling of the little bells. It provided a fitting background chorus to a decision which had been made in fucking fairyland, not on the battlefield where we, like it or not, most certainly were. Axe said again, "We're not murderers, and we would not have been murderers, whatever we'd done." Mikey was sympathetic to his view. He just said, I know, Axe. I know, buddy. But we just took a vote. I motioned for the three goat herds to get up, and I signaled them with my rifle to go on their way. They never gave one nod or smile of gratitude, and they surely knew we might very well have killed them. They turned toward the higher ground behind us. I can see them now. They put their hands behind their backs in that peculiar Afghan way and broke into a very fast jog up the steep gradient, the goats around us now trotting along to join them. From somewhere, a skinny, mangy brown dog appeared dolefully and joined the kid. That dog was a gruesome Afghan reminder of my own robust chocolate Labrador, Emma, back home on the ranch, always bursting with health and joy. I guess that's when I woke up and stopped worrying about the goddamned American liberals. "This is bad," I said. "This is real bad. What the fuck are we doing?" Axe shook his head. Danny shrugged. Mikey, to be fair, looked as if he had seen a ghost. Like me, he was a man who knew a massive mistake had just been made. More chilling than anything we had ever done together. Where were those guys headed? Were we crazy, or what? Thoughts raced through my mind. We'd had no comms, no one we could turn to for advice. Thus far, we had no semblance of a target in the village. We were in a very exposed position, and we appeared to have no access to air support. We couldn't even report in. Worse yet, we had no clue as to where the goat herds were headed. When things go this bad, it's never one thing. It's every damn thing. We watched them go, disappearing up the mountain, still running, still with their hands behind their backs. And the sense that we had done something terrible by letting them go was all-pervading. I could just tell. Not one of us was able to speak. We were like four zombies, hardly knowing whether to crash back into our former surveillance spots or leave right away. "What now?" asked Danny. Mikey began to gather his gear. "Move in five," he said. We packed up our stuff, and right there in the noonday sun, we watched the goat herds, far on the high horizon, finally disappear from view. By my watch, it was precisely 19 minutes after their departure, and the mood of sheer gloom enveloped us all. We set off up the mountain, following in the hoofprints of the goats and their masters. We moved as fast as we could, but it took us between 40 minutes and 1 hour to cover the same steep ground. At the top, we could no longer see them. Mountain goats, mountain herders. They were all the goddamn same, and they could move like rockets up in the passes. We searched around for the trail we had arrived by, found it, and set off back toward the initial spot, the one we had pulled out of because of the poor angle on the village and then the dense fog bank. We tried the radio and still could not make a connection with home base. Our offensive policy was in pieces, but we were headed for probably the best defensive position we had found since we got here, on the brink of the mountain wall, maybe 40 yards from the summit, with tree cover and decent concealment. Right now, we sensed we must remain in strictly defensive mode, lie low for a while, and hope the Taliban had not been alerted, or if they had, that we would be too well hidden for them to locate us. We were excellent practitioners of lying low and hiding. We walked on along the side of the mountain, and I have to say, the place looked kind of different in broad daylight. But its virtues were still there. Even from the top of the escarpment, we would be damn near impossible to see. We climbed down and took up our precise old positions. We were still essentially carrying out our mission, but we remained on the highest possible alert for Taliban fighters. Below me, maybe 30 yards to my right, looking up the hill, Danny slipped neatly into his yoga tree, cross-legged, still looking like a snake charmer.
I got myself wedged into the old mulberry tree, where I reapplied my camouflage cream and melted into the landscape. Below me on the left, same distance as Danny, was Axe with our heaviest rifle. Mikey was right below me, maybe 10 yards, jammed into the lee of a boulder. Above us, the mountain was nearly sheer. Then it went flat for a few yards, then it angled sharply up to the top. I'd tried looking down from there, so had Murph, and we were agreed you could not really see anything over the small outward ridge which protected us. For the moment, we were safe. Axe had the glass for 20 minutes, and then I took over for the next 20 minutes. Nothing stirred in the village. It had now been more than an hour and a half since we turned the goat herds loose, and it was still quiet and peaceful, hardly a breath of wind. And by Christ, it was hot. Mikey was closest to me when he suddenly whispered, "Guys, I've got an idea." "What is it, sir?" I asked, suddenly formal, as if our situation demanded some respect for the man who must ultimately take command. "I'm going down to the village, see if I can borrow a phone."
"Beautiful," said Axe. "See if you can pick me up a sandwich."
"Sure," said Mikey. "What'll it be, mule dung or goat's hoof?"
"Hold the mayo," growled Axe.
The jokes weren't that great, I know, but perched up there on this Afghan rock face, poised to fend off an attacking army, I thought they were only just shy of grade one hilarity. It was, I suppose, a sign of nerves, like cracking a one-liner on your deathbed. But it showed we all felt better now, not absolutely A-okay, but cheerful enough to get to our work and toss out the occasional light remark. More like our old selves, right? Anyhow, I said I was just going to close my eyes for a short while, and I pulled my camouflage hat down over my eyes and tried to nod off, despite my pounding heart, which I could not slow down. Around 10 minutes more passed. Suddenly, I heard Mikey make a familiar alert sound. "Sst, sst." I lifted up my hat and instinctively looked left over my port side quarter to the spot where I knew Axe would be covering our flank. And he was right there, rigid, in firing position, his rifle aimed straight up the mountain. I twisted around to look directly behind me. Mikey was staring wide-eyed up the hill, calling orders, instructing Danny to call in immediate backup from HQ if he could make the radio work. He saw I was on the case, looked hard at me, and pointed straight up the hill, urging me with hand signals to do the same. I fixed my Mark 12 in firing position, pulled my head back a few inches, and looked up the hill. Lined along the top were between 80 and 100 heavily armed Taliban warriors, each one of them with an AK-47 pointing downward. Some were carrying rocket-propelled grenades. To the right and to the left, they were starting to move down our flanks. I knew they could see past me, but not at me. They could not have seen Axe or Danny. I was unsure whether they had seen Mikey. My heart dropped directly into my stomach, and I cursed those fucking goat herds to hell, and myself for not executing them when every military codebook ever written had taught me otherwise. Not to mention my own raging instincts, which had told me to go with Axe and execute them, and let the liberals go to hell in a mule cart, and take with them all of their fucking know-nothing rules of etiquette in war and human rights and whatever other bullshit makes them happy. You want to charge us with murder? Well, fucking do it. But at least we'll be alive to answer it. This way really sucks. I pressed back against my tree. I was still sure they had not seen me, but their intention was to outflank us on both wings. I could see that. I scanned the ground directly above me. The hilltop still swarmed with armed men. I thought there were more than before. There was no escape by going straight up, and no possibility of moving left or right. Essentially, they had us trapped, if they had spotted us. I still was unsure. And so far, not a shot had been fired. I looked up the hill again at one single tree above and to my left, maybe 20 yards away, and I thought I saw movement. Then it was confirmed, first by a turbine, then by an AK-47, its barrel pointed in my general direction, though not directly at me. I tightened my grip on the trusty rifle and moved it slightly in the direction of the tree. Whoever it was still could not see me because I was in a great spot, well hidden. I kept perfectly still. That's goddamned motionless, like a marble statue. I checked with Mikey, who also had not moved. Then I checked the tree again, and this time that turban was around it. A hook-nosed Taliban warrior was peering straight at me through black eyes above a thick black beard. The barrel of his AK-47 was pointed right at my head. Had he seen me? Would he open fire? How did the liberals feel about my position? No time, I guess. I fired once, blew his head off. And at that moment, all hell broke loose. The Taliban unleashed an avalanche of gunfire at us, straight down the mountain from every angle. Axe flanked left, trying to cut off the downward trail, firing nonstop. Mikey was blasting away straight over my head with everything he had. Danny was firing at them, trying to aim with one hand, desperately trying to rev up the radio with the other. I could hear Mikey shouting, "Danny! Danny, for Christ's sake, get that fucking thing working! Marcus, no options now, buddy! Kill 'em all!" But now, the enemy gunfire seemed to center on our two flank men. I could see the dust and rock shards kicking up all around us. The sound of AK-47s absolutely filled the air, deafening. I could see the Taliban guys falling all along the ridge. No one can shoot like us. I stayed right where I was, in my original position, and I still seemed to be taking less fire than the others. But in the next couple of minutes, they had identified my position, and the volume of fire directly at me was increasing. This was bad. Very bad. I could see Axe was acquiring his targets quicker than I was because he had an extra scope. I should have had one too, but for some reason I had not fitted it. Right now, all four of us were really amped up. We knew how to conduct a firefight like this, but we needed to cut down the enemy numbers, nail a few of these bastards real quick, give ourselves a better chance. It was hard for them to get us from directly above, which meant the flanks were our danger. I could see two of them making their way down, right and left. Axe shot one of them, but it was bad to the right. They were shooting in a kind of frenzy, but thank Christ, missing. I guess we were too, and suddenly I was taking heavy fire myself. Bullets were slamming into the tree trunk, hitting rocks all around me. The bullets were somehow coming in from the sides. I called down to Mikey, "We'll take 'em, but we might just need a new spot." "Roger that," he yelled back. Like me, he could see the speed at which they were moving up into the attack. We'd been shooting them for all of 5 or 6 minutes, but every time we cleared that ridge high above us, it filled up again. It was as if they had reinforcements somewhere over the ridge just waiting to come up to the front line. Whichever way we looked at it, they had a ton of guys trying to kill four SEALs. At this point, our options were non-existent. We still could not charge the top of the mountain because they'd cut us down like dogs. They had us left, and they had us right. We were boxed in on three sides, and there was never, not even for a couple of seconds, a lull in the gunfire. And we could not even see half of them or tell where the bullets were coming from. They had every angle on us. All four of us just kept banging away, cutting them down, watching them fall, slamming a new magazine into the breech, somehow holding them at bay. But this was impossible.
We had to give up this high ground, and I had to get close enough to Mikey to agree on a strategy, hopefully to save our lives. I started to move, but Mikey, like the brilliant officer he was, had appreciated the situation and already called it. Fall back! Fall back? More like fall off, the freaking mountain, that is, a nearly sheer drop right behind us. God knows how far down. But an order's an order. I grabbed my gear and took a sideways step, trying to zigzag down the gradient. But gravity made the decision for me, and I fell headlong down the mountain, completing a full forward flip and somehow landing on my back, still going fast, heels flailing for a foothold. At least I thought I was going fast, but Murphy was right behind me. I could tell it was him because of the bright red New York City fireman's patch he'd worn since 9/11. That was actually all I saw. "See you at the bottom," I yelled. But right then I hit a tree, and Mikey went past me like a bullet. I was going slower now, and I tried to take a step, but I fell again, and on I went, catching up to Mikey now, crashing, tumbling over the ground like we were both bouncing through a pinball machine. Ahead of us was a copse of trees on a slightly less steep gradient, and I knew this was our last hope before we plunged into the void. I had to grab something, anything. So did Mikey, and I could see him up ahead, grabbing at tree limbs, snapping them off, and still plummeting downward. In a split second, I knew that nothing could save either of us. We'd surely break our backs or necks, and then the Taliban would shoot us without mercy, as we would expect. But right now, entering the copse of trees at what felt like 70 miles an hour, my mind was in overdrive. Almost everything had been ripped away from me in the fall. Everything except my ammunition and grenades. All my packs, the medical stuff, food, water, comms, phone. I'd even lost my helmet with the flag of Texas painted on it. I was damned if I wanted some fucking terrorist wearing that. I'd seen Mikey's radio aerial ripped off as we crashed downward, and that was not good. My gun strap had been ripped off me, and my rifle whipped away. The trouble was, the terrain beyond the tree copse was completely unknown to us, because we could not see it from above. If we had, we might never have jumped. The ground just swept upward and then ducked away downward, inverted, like a goddamn ski jump. I rocketed up the lip of that backslope, making about 80 knots, on my back, feet first. In the air, I made two complete backflips, and I landed again, feet first, on my back, still coming down the cliff face like a howitzer shell. And at that moment, I knew there was a God. First of all, I appeared not to be dead, which was right up there with Jesus walking on the water. But even more amazing was I could see my rifle not 2 feet from my right hand, as if God himself had reached down to me and given me hope. "Marcus," I heard him say, "you're gonna need this." At least, I think I heard him. In fact, I swear to God I heard him. Because this was a miracle, no doubt in my mind, and I had not even had time to say my prayers. I didn't know how far down we'd fallen, but it must have been 200 or 300 yards, and we were both still going very fast. I could see Mikey up ahead, and I honestly did not know whether he was dead or alive. It was just a person crashing through the dirt and boulders. If he had not broken every bone in his body, that too was a miracle. Me? I was too battered to hurt, and I could still see my rifle tumbling down beside me. That rifle never strayed more than 2 feet from my hand throughout this death-defying fall, and I'll always know it was guided by the hand of God, because there is no other explanation. We hit the bottom, both of us landing with terrific impact, like we jumped off a goddamned skyscraper. It shook the wind out of me, and I gasped for breath, trying to work out how badly injured I was. My right shoulder hurt, my back hurt, and on one side of my face, the skin had been more or less scoured away. I was covered in blood and bruised to hell. But I could stand, which was actually a really bad idea, because then the RPGs began to arrive, landing close, and I went down again. They exploded more or less harmlessly, but sent up clouds of dust, shale, and wood shards from the trees. Mikey was next to me, maybe 15 feet away, and we picked ourselves up from the ground. He still had his rifle strapped on. Mine was resting at my feet. I grabbed it, and I heard Murphy shout through the din of explosions, "You good?" I turned to him, and his entire face was black with dust. Even his goddamned teeth were black. "You look like shit, man," I told him. "Fix yourself up." Despite everything, Mikey laughed. And then I noticed he'd been shot during the fall. There was blood pumping out of his stomach. But just then, there was a thunderous explosion from one of the grenades too close, much too close. We both wheeled around in the swirling dust and smoke, and there behind us were two large logs, actually felled trees. They were crossed over at the ends, like a pair of giant chopsticks facing up the mountain, and we turned simultaneously and sprinted for cover. We cleared the logs and crashed down behind them, safe from gunfire attack for the moment. We were both still armed and ready to fight. I took the right-hand side, Mikey center left, guarding both the head-on approach and the flank. We could see them plainly now, swarming down the flanks of the cliff we had just crashed down. They were moving very fast, though not nearly as fast as we had. Mikey had a pretty good line on them, and mine wasn't bad. We opened fire straight at them, picking them off one by one as they moved in on us. Trouble was, there were so many, and it didn't seem to matter how many we killed, they just kept coming. I remember thinking that the 200 estimate was a lot closer than the 80 minimum we had been advised. And this must have been Sharmak's work, because these guys were not really marksmen, were using marginal rifles pretty recklessly, but nonetheless followed the military rules for this type of assault. They advanced down the side of the battlefield, trying to outflank their enemy, always attempting to get a 360-degree cover on their target. We were surely slowing their progress down, but we weren't stopping them. The fire never slackened for 5 minutes. They had sustained non-stop that opening volley, the one fired way back up the mountain when they could not see their target. They had blasted away at us all the way down to these logs, and they had augmented their fire with aimed rocket-propelled grenades. These guys were not being led by some mad-eyed hysteric. They were being led by someone who understood the rudiments of what he was doing. Understood them well. Too well. The fucker. And now they had us pinned down behind the logs, and as ever, the bullets were flying, but we were somehow getting the better of the exchanges. Mikey was ignoring his wound and fighting like a SEAL officer should, uncompromising, steady, hard-eyed, and professional. I could see the guys on that left flank dropping down in their tracks as they raced toward us. On my side, over on the right, the ground was just a little flatter, with trees, and there did not seem to be so many of them. Every time they moved, I shot them. It was probably clear to them that Mikey and I could not be dislodged as long as the big logs covered us. And that's when they went to their biggest barrage of RPGs yet. These damn things, trailing that familiar white smoke, were unleashed at us from farther up the mountain. They landed to the front and the side, but not behind, and they caused a tidal wave of dirt,
rocks and smoke showering us with the stuff, robbing us of our vision. Our heads went down, and I asked Mikey where the hell were Axe and Danny, and of course, neither of us knew. All we knew was they were up the mountain, not yet having jumped as we had.
"Guess Axe must have dug in and kept fighting out on the left," he said. "Danny's got a better chance of radio contact high up than he would down here."
We risked a look up through the gloom, and we saw a figure plummeting down the mountain just to the left of where we had fallen. Axe, no doubt. But could he survive that fall? He was on the first slope before the trees, and a second later, he hurtled over the ski jump, flipped, and crashed on down the almost sheer cliff face. The gradient saved him, as it had saved Mikey and me, the way the steep mountain saves a ski jumper, enabling him to continue down at high speed without a terminal collision with flat ground. Axe arrived in one piece, stunned and disoriented. But the Taliban could see him now, and they opened fire on him as he lay on the ground.
"Run, Axe! Right here, buddy! Run!"
yelled Murph, top of his lungs. And Axe recovered his senses real quick, bullets flying around him, and he cleared those logs and crashed into our hide, landing on his back. It's unbelievable what you can do when the threat to your own life is that bad. He took the far left, slammed a new magazine into the breech, and started fighting, never missed a beat, hammering away at our most vulnerable point of enemy attack. The three of us just kept going, shooting them down, hoping and praying their numbers would lessen, that we had punched a hole in their assault. But it sure as hell never seemed like it. Those guys were still swarming, still firing, and the noise was still deafening. The question was, where was Danny? Was that little mountain lion still fighting, still trying to make contact as he pounded away at Sharmak's troops? Was he still trying to get through to HQ? None of us knew, but the answer was not long in arriving. From high up on the right, on the main cliff face, there was a sudden, unusual movement. Someone was falling, and it had to be Danny. The flailing body crashed through the high woods and flipped at the ski jump, tumbling all the way to the bottom, where it landed with a sickening thump. Just as we all had. But Danny never moved. Just lay there, either stunned or dead. And the folklore of the Brotherhood stood starkly before both Mikey and me. No SEAL was ever left alone to die on the battlefield. No SEAL. I dropped my rifle and cleared the log in one bound. Mikey came right after me. Axe kept firing, trying to give us cover as we ducked down and ran fast across the flat ground to the base of the cliff. Mikey was still pouring blood from his stomach, and I felt like I had a broken back, low down, base of my spine. We reached Danny together, hoisted him up, and manhandled him back to the logs, dragging him into what passed for safety around here. They fired at us from the heights all the way across that lethal ground, but no one got hit. And somehow, against truly staggering odds, we were all still going, all in one piece, except for the shot Mikey took. As the resident medic, I should have been able to help, but all my stuff had been ripped away in the fall, and there was no time to do anything except shoot these bastards who carried AK-47s and hope to Christ they'd give up, or at least run out of those RPGs. They could hurt someone if they weren't careful. Fuckers. Right then, I was confident we were going to make it. The ground fell away quite sharply behind us, but way below was our target village, and it was on flat ground with sturdy-looking houses. Cover. That was all we needed, with our enemy caught flat-footed on flat ground. We'd be all right. We'd get 'em. Danny fought back, cleared his head, and tried to get up, but his face was rigid. He was in terrible pain.
and then I saw the blood pouring out of his hand.
"I've been shot, Marcus. Can you help me?" he said.
"We've all been shot," replied Mikey. "Can you fight?" I stared at Danny's right hand. His thumb had been blown right off, and I saw him grit his teeth and nod, sweat streaming down his blackened face. He adjusted his rifle, banged in a new magazine with the butt of his hand, and took his place in the center of our little gun line. Then he turned to face the enemy once more. He was a bull mastiff, glaring up the mountain, and he opened fire with everything he had. Danny, Mikey, and Axe blasted that left flank while I held the right. The fire was still fierce on all sides, but we sensed there were more dead Afghans to the left than there were to the right. Murph shouted,
"We're going for the higher ground, this side!"
And with all four barrels blazing, we tried to storm that left flank, get a foothold on the steep slope, maybe even fight our way back to the top if we could kill enough of them. But they also wanted the higher ground, and they reinforced their right flank, driving down from the top anything to stop us getting that upper hand. We must have killed 50 or more of them, and all four of us were still fighting. I guess they probably noticed that, because they were prepared to fight to the last man to hold our left, their right. There were so many of them, and we found ourselves slipping inexorably back down the hill as the turbaned warriors closed in on us, driving us back by sheer weight of numbers, sheer volume of fire. When they loosed off another battery of RPGs, we had no other option but to retreat and dive back behind the crossed logs before they blew our heads off. God only knew the size of whatever arms cache they were drawing ordnance from, but we were just finding out what a force Sharmak and his guys really were, trained, heavily armed, fearless, and strategically on the ball. Not quite what we expected when we first landed at Bagram. Back behind the logs, we kept going, mowing them down on the flanks whenever we could get a clear shot. But again, the inflexible, unswerving progress of Sharmak's forces coming down the escarpment after us was simply too overwhelming. Not so much due to the volume of fire, but because of their irresistible drive down the left and right of our position. The logs gave us good cover from the front, and not bad to 90 degrees. But once they got past that, firing from slightly behind us on both sides, well, that was the reason we jumped from the heights in the first place, risking our necks, not knowing when or even if we would land on reasonable ground. There were not enough of us to protect our flanks. We were too occupied defending our position against a head-on attack. I suppose the goat herds had told them we were only four, and Sharmak swiftly guessed we would be vulnerable on the wings. I'm guessing a dozen seals could have held and then destroyed them, but that would have been odds of around 10 or 11 to 1. We were only four, and that was probably 35 to 1, which is known in military vernacular as a balls-to-the-wall situation. Especially as we now seemed incapable of calling up the cavalry from HQ. Right here was a 21st century version of General Custer's last stand, Little Bighorn, with turbans. But they hadn't gotten us yet, and if I had my way, they were never going to. I know all four of us thought exactly that. Our only option, however, was to get to flatter ground. And there wasn't any of that up here. There was only one way for us to go, backward and down. Straight down. Mike Murphy called it.
"They'll kill us all if we stay here. Jump, guys! For fuck's sake, jump!"
And once more, all four of us clutched our rifles, stood up, braved the flying bullets, and headed for the precipice. We leaped into the void, Mikey first, me next, then Axe, then Danny.
The drop must have been about 30 or 40 feet down into a thicket of shrubs alongside a little stream. We were by no means at the base of this little escarpment, but at least we were once more on a flat bit and not clinging to some cliff face. I landed directly on top of Mikey, then Axe and Danny landed on both of us. There wasn't even time to let rip with a few curses. We spread out and took up firing position again, preparing once more to blast the enemy away from our flanks, where they would be sure to begin their advance in the next stage of the battle. They were clambering down the rocks to our right, and I was trying to make sure none of them made it to the bottom. My rifle felt red hot, and I just kept loading and shooting, aiming and firing, wishing to hell I still had my Texas helmet. We were trying to move into a decent position, jumping between the rocks, working our way out into open ground. But we were picking up fire now. The Taliban had seen us and were raining bullets down, firing from a prime overhead spot. We moved back against the rocks, and Danny was shot again. They hit him in his lower back, and the bullet blew out of his stomach. He was still firing, Christ knows how, but he was. Danny's mouth was open, and there was blood trickling out. There was blood absolutely everywhere. It was hot, and the stench of it was unmistakable. The cordite was heavy in the air, and the noise, which had not abated since they first opened fire, was deafening. Our ears were ringing from the blasts like we were wearing headphones. And then they opened up with the grenades again. We saw the white smoke streaking through the air. We saw them coming, winging down that canyon right onto us. And when they blew, the blast was overpowering, echoing from the granite rocks that surrounded us on three sides. It was like the world was blowing up around us, with the flying rock splinters, some of them pretty large, clattering off the cliff walls, the ricocheting bullets, the swirling dust cloud enveloping the shrapnel and covering us, choking us, obscuring everything. Murph was trying to reassess the situation, desperately trying to make the right decision despite our limited options. And let's face it, the options had not changed very much since I first slammed a bullet between that guy's eyes from behind the tree. Right now, we were not hemmed in on our flanks. Our enemy was dead ahead. That, and straight up. Overhead. And that's bad. I guess the oldest military strategy in the world is to gain the higher ground. In my experience, no Taliban commander had ever ordered his men to fight from anything other than the high ground. And did they ever have it now? If we'd been in a cornfield, it would have been nothing like so dangerous because the bullets would have hit the earth and stayed there. But we were in a granite-walled corner, and everything bounced off at about a zillion miles per hour, which is more or less the definition of a ricochet. Everything, bullets, shrapnel, and fragments, came zinging off those rocks. It seemed to us like the Taliban were getting double value for every shot. If the bullet missed, watch the hell out for the ricochet. And how much longer we could go on taking this kind of bombardment without getting ourselves killed was anyone's guess. Murph and Danny had picked up the fight on the left and were still firing, still hitting them pretty good. I was firing upward, trying to pick them off between the rocks, and Axe had jammed himself into a good spot in the rocks and was blazing away at the oncoming turbines. Both Murph and I were hoping for a lull in the fire, which would signify we had killed a significant number. But that never came. What came were reinforcements, Taliban reinforcements. Groups of guys moving up, replacing their dead, joining the front line of this wide-ranging, large force on their home ground, armed to the teeth, and still unable to kill even one of us. We tried to take the fight to them, concentrating on their strongest positions, pushing them to reinforce their line of battle. No three guys ever fought with higher courage
than my buddies up there in those mountains, and damn near surrounded as we were, we still believed we would ultimately defeat our enemy. We still had plenty of ammunition. But then, Danny was shot again. Right through the neck, and he went down beside me. He dropped his rifle and slumped to the ground. I reached down to grab him and drag him closer to the rock face, but he managed to clamber to his feet, trying to tell me he was okay, even though he'd been shot 4 times. Danny couldn't speak now, but he wouldn't give in. He propped himself up against a rock for cover and opened fire again at the Taliban, signaling he might need a new magazine as his very lifeblood poured out of him. I just stood there for a moment, helplessly, fighting back my tears, witnessing a brand of valor I had never before been privileged to see. What a guy. What a friend. Murph called out to me,
"The only way's down, kid."
As if I didn't know, I called back,
"Roger that, sir."
I knew he meant the village, and it was true. That was our chance. If we could grab one of those houses and make a stand, we would be hard to dislodge. 4 SEALs firing from solid cover will usually get the job done. All we needed to do was coax the Taliban down there. Although if things didn't get a whole lot better in the next few minutes, we might not make it ourselves. Chapter 8. The Final Battle for Murphy's Ridge. The ground shook. The very few trees swayed. The noise was worse than any blast all day. This was one gigantic Taliban effort to finish us. We hit the deck to avoid the lethal flying debris, rock fragments, and shrapnel. Lieutenant Mike Murphy bellowed out the command, the 3rd time he had done so in the battle. Same mountain, same command.
"Fall back! Axe and Marcus first!"
Again, he really meant fall off, and we were all getting real used to it. Axe and I sprinted for the edge, while Murph and Danny, tucked into the rocks, drew fire and covered our escape. I had no idea whether Danny could even move again, with all his wounds. Lying right along the top of the cliff was a tree trunk with a kind of hollow underneath it, as if it had been washed out by the rains. Axe, who could think quicker on his feet than most people I've ever met, made straight for that hole because the tree trunk would give him cover as he plunged down to whatever the hell was over the goddamned cliff. The slimly built axe hit the ground like a javelin, skidded fast into the hollow, shot straight under the log, and out into space. I hit the ground like a Texas longhorn and came to a grinding halt, stuck fast under the log. Couldn't go forward, couldn't go back. Fuck me. Was this a bummer or what? The Taliban had seen me by now. I was the only one they could see, and I heard a volley of bullets screaming around me. 1 shot smacked into the tree just to my right. The rest were hitting the dirt and sending up puffs of dust. I heaved at the log. I heaved with all my might, but I could not move that sucker. I was pinned down. I was trying to look backward, wondering if Mikey had seen me and might try a rescue, when suddenly I saw the stark white smoke trail of an incoming RPG against the mountain. The RPG smashed into the tree trunk right next to me and exploded with a shattering blast as I tried frantically to turn away from it. I can't tell what happened next, but it blew the goddamn trunk clean in half and shot me straight over the cliff. I guess it was about 15 feet down to where Axe was moving into firing position, and I landed close. Considering I'd just been blown over the ledge like a freaking human cannonball, I was pretty lucky to be still standing. And there, right next to me on the ground, was my rifle, placed there by the hand of God himself. I reached down to pick it up and listened again for his voice. But this time, there was no noise, just one brief second of silence in my mind amid all the chaos and malevolence of this monstrous struggle for supremacy, apparently being conducted on behalf of his holy prophet Muhammad. I was not sure whether either of them would have approved. I don't know that much about Muhammad, but by all that's holy, I don't think my own God wished me to die. If he had been indifferent to my plight, he surely would not have taken such good care of my gun, right? Because how on earth that was still with me, I will never know. That rifle had so far fought three separate battles in three different places, been ripped out of my grasp twice, been blown over a cliff by a powerful grenade, fallen almost 900 feet down a mountain, and was still, somehow, right next to my outstretched hand. Fluke? Believe what you will. My own faith will remain forever unshaken. Anyhow, I picked it up and moved back into the rocks where Axe was now picking up fire from the enemy. But he was well positioned and fighting back, blazing away on the left, the flank for which he'd fought so desperately for so long. Actually, it had been about 40 minutes, but it seemed like 10 years, and we were both still going. So, for that matter, were Mikey and Danny, and somehow they had both made the leap down here to the lower level, near the stream where the Taliban assault was not quite so bad. Yet. We looked, by the way, shocking, especially Danny, who was covered head to toe in blood. Axe was okay, but badly battered, and Mikey was soaked in blood from that stomach wound. Not as bad as Danny, but not pretty. When that grenade blew me over the cliff, it probably should have killed me. But the only new injury I had sustained was a broken nose, which I got when I hit the deck semi-conscious. To be honest, it hurt like hell, along with my back, and I was bleeding all over my gear. However, I had not been seriously shot, as two of my team had. Axe was holding the tribesmen off, leaning calmly on a rock, firing up the hill, the very picture of an elite warrior in combat. No panic, rock steady, firing accurately, conserving his ammunition, missing nothing. I was close to him in a similar stance, and we were both hitting them pretty good. One guy suddenly jumped up from nowhere a little above us, and I shot him dead, about 30 yards range. But we were trapped again. There were still around 80 of these maniacs coming down at us, and that's a heck of a lot of enemies. I'm not sure what their casualty rate was, because both Mikey and I estimated Sharmak had thrown 140 men minimum into this fight. Whatever, they were still there, and I was not sure how long Danny could keep going. Mikey worked his way alongside me and said with vintage Murphy humor, "Man, this really sucks." I turned to face him and told him, "We're gonna fucking die out here if we're not careful." "I know," he replied. And the battle raged on, the massed wild gunfire of a very determined enemy against our more accurate, better trained response, superior concentration, and war fighting know-how. Once more, hundreds of bullets were ricocheting around our rocky surroundings, and once more, the Taliban went to the grenades, blasting the terrain around us to pieces. Jammed between rocks, we kept firing. But Danny was in all kinds of trouble, and I was afraid he might lose consciousness. That was when they shot him again, right at the base of the neck. I watched in horror as Danny went down, this beautiful guy, husband of Patsy, a friend of mine for 4 years. A guy who had always been last away while we retreated. A guy who had provided our covering fire until he couldn't stand anymore. And now he lay on the ground, blood pouring from his 5 wounds. And I was supposed to be a fucking SEAL medic, and I could not do a damn thing for him without getting us all killed. I dropped my rifle and climbed over the rock, running across open ground to get to him. All right, all right. No hero bullshit. I was crying like a baby. Danny was saturated in blood, still conscious, still trying to fire his rifle at the enemy. But he was in a face-down position. I told him to take it easy while I turned him over. Come on, Dan. We're gonna be all right. He nodded, and I knew he could not speak and would probably never speak again. What I really remember is he would not let go of his rifle. I raised him by the shoulders and hauled him into an almost sitting position. Then, grasping him under the arms, I started to drag him backward toward cover. And would you believe, that little Iron Man opened fire at the enemy once again, almost lying on his back, blasting away up the hill, while I kept dragging. We'd gone about 8 yards when everything I dreaded came true. Here I was, just about defenseless, trying to walk backward, both hands full, when a Taliban fighter suddenly loomed up out of the rocks to our right. He was right on top of us, looking down, a smile on his face as he aimed that AK-47 straight at my head. Neither of us saw him in time to return fire. I just said a quick prayer and stared back at him, which was precisely when Axe banged 2 bullets right between his eyes, killed that tribesman stone dead instantly. I didn't have time to thank him, because the grenades were still coming in, and I just kept trying to drag Danny to safety. And like Axe, Danny kept firing. I got him to the rock face just a few yards from Mikey, and it was clear the enemy had nearly managed to surround us for the 4th time today. We could tell by the direction of the gunfire and occasionally the RPGs. Danny was still alive and willing to fight, and Mikey was now fighting shoulder to shoulder with Axe, and they were inflicting heavy damage. I still thought we had a chance of getting out, but once more, the only option was down, toward that village and on to the flat ground. Fighting uphill, as we had been doing since this battle started, did, in the words of our mission officer, really suck. I yelled out loudly, "Axe, moving!" He had time to shout back, "Roger that!" before they shot him in the chest. I watched his rifle fall from his grasp. He slumped forward and slipped down the rock he'd been leaning on all the way to the ground. I absolutely froze. This could not be happening. Matt Axelson, a family fixture, Morgan's best friend, a part of our lives. I started calling his name irrationally, over and over. Privately, I thought Danny was dying, and all I could see was a stain of blood gathering in the red dirt where Axe was slumped. For a brief moment, I thought I might be losing it. But then Axe reached for his rifle and got up. He leveled the weapon, got a hold of another magazine, shoved it into the breech, and opened fire again, blood pumping out of his chest. He held his same firing position, leaning against the rock. He showed the same attitude of solid Navy SEAL know-how, the same formidable steadiness, staring through his scope, those brilliant blue eyes of his scanning the terrain. When Axe got up, it was the bravest thing I ever saw. Except for Danny, except for Mikey, still commanding us after taking a bullet through his stomach so early in the battle. And now Murph was masterminding a way down the escarpment. He had chosen the route and called up Axe to follow him down, and still the bullets were humming around us as the Taliban started their pursuit. Mikey and Axe were about 75 yards in front, and I was dragging Danny along while he did everything he could to help, trying to walk, trying to give us covering fire. "It's okay, Danny," I kept saying. "We just need to catch up with the others. It's gonna be all right." Right then, a bullet caught him full in the upper part of his face. I heard it hit home. I turned to help him, and the blood from his head wound spilled over us both. I called out to him, but it was too late. He wasn't fighting the terrible pain anymore, and he couldn't hear me. Danny Dietz died right there in my arms. I don't know how quickly hearts break, but that nearly broke mine. And still, the gunfire never abated. I dragged Danny off the open ground, maybe 5 feet, and then I said goodbye to him. I lowered him down, and I had to leave him or else die out here with him. But I knew one thing for certain. I still had my rifle, and I was not alone, and neither was Danny, a devout Roman Catholic. I left him with God. And now I had to get back to help my team. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. To this day, I have nightmares about it. A chilling dream where Danny's still talking to me, and there's blood everywhere, and I have to walk away, and I don't even know why. I always wake up in tears, and it will always haunt me, and it's never going to go away. And now I could hear Murph yelling to me. I grabbed my rifle, ducked down, slipped, and fell off a rock, then started to run toward him and Axe while they provided heavy covering fire non-stop aimed at the Taliban's rocky redoubt, maybe another 40 yards back. I reached the edge, ran almost blindly into a tree, bounced off, skidded down the slope, which was not very deep, and landed on my head right in the fucking stream. Like any good frogman, I was seriously pissed off because my boots got wet. I really hate that. Finally, I caught up with them. Axe was out of ammunition, and I gave him a new magazine. Mikey wanted to know where Danny was, and I had to tell him that Danny had died. He was appalled, completely shocked, and so was Axe. Although Mikey would not say it, I knew he wanted to go back for the body. But we both knew there was no time and no reason. We had nowhere to take the remains of a fallen teammate, and we could not continue this firefight while carrying around a body. Danny was dead. And strangely, I was the first to pull myself together. I said suddenly, "I'll tell you what, we have to get down this goddamn mountain or we'll all be dead." And as if to make up our minds for us, the Taliban were again closing in, trying to make that 360-degree movement around us. And they were doing it. Gunfire was coming in from underneath us now. We could see the tribesmen still swarming, and I tried to count them as I had been trying to do for almost an hour. I thought there were now only about 50, maybe 60. But the bullets were still flying, the grenades were still coming in, blasting close, sending up dust clouds of smoke and dirt with flying bits of rock. There had never been a lull in the amount of ordnance the enemy was piling down on us. Right now, again, tucked low behind rocks, the three of us could look down and see the village, 1.5 miles distant, and it remained our objective. Again, I told Mikey, "If we can just make it down there and get some cover, we'll take them all out on the flat ground." I knew we were not in great shape, but we were still SEALs. Nothing can ever take that away. We were still confident, and we were never going to surrender. If it came down to it, we would fight to the death with our knives against their guns. "Fuck surrender," said Mikey. And he had no need to explain further, either to Axe or me. Surrender would have been a disgrace to our community, like ringing the bell at the edge of the grinder and putting your helmet in the line. No one who had made it through this far, to this no man's land in the Afghan mountains, would have dreamed of giving up. Remember the philosophy of the U.S. Navy SEALs. "I will never quit. My nation expects me to be physically harder and mentally stronger than my enemies. If knocked down, I will get back up every time. I will draw on every remaining ounce of strength to protect my teammates. I am never out of the fight. Those words have sustained many brave men down the years. They were engraved upon the soul of every SEAL, and they were in the minds of all of us. Mikey suddenly said, above the rage of the battle, "Remember, bro, we're never out of it." I nodded tersely. "It's only about another 1,000 yards to flat ground. If we can just get down there, we got a chance." Trouble was, we couldn't get down there. At least, not right then, because once more, we were pinned down. And we faced the same dilemma. The only escape was to go down, but our only defensive strategy was to go up. Once more, we had to get off this ground, away from the ricochets, back up the left flank. We were trying to fight the battle our way, but even though we were still going, we were battered half to death. I led the way back up the rocks, blasting away, shooting down anyone I could see. But they caught on to that real quick, and now they really unloaded on us. Russian-made rocket grenades coming straight down their right flank, our left. The ground shook. The very few trees swayed. The noise was worse than any blast all day. Even the walls of this little canyon shook. The stream splashed over its banks. This was one gigantic Taliban effort to finish us. We hit the deck, jamming ourselves into our rocky crevasse, heads down to avoid the lethal flying debris, rock fragments, and shrapnel. As before, they did not kill anyone with this type of thunderous bombardment, and as before, they waited till the dust had cleared, and then opened fire again. Above me, I could see the tree line. It was not close, but it was nearer than the village. But the Taliban knew our objective, and as we tried to fight our way forward, they drove us back with sheer weight of fire. We'd tried against all the odds and just could not make it. They'd knocked us back again, and we retreated down, making a long, pathetic loop back the way we'd come. But once more, we landed up in a good spot, a sound defensive position, well protected by the rock face on either side. Again, we tried to take the fight to them, picking our targets and driving them back, making some ground now toward the village. They were up and screaming at us, yelling as the battle almost became close quarters. We yelled right back and kept firing, but there were still so many of them. And then they got into better position and shot Mikey Murphy through the chest. He came toward me, asking if I could give him another magazine, and then I saw Axe stumbling toward me, his head pushed out, blood running down his face, bubbling out of the most shocking head wound.
"They shot me, bro," he said. "The bastard shot me. Can you help me, Marcus?"
What could I say? What could I do? I couldn't help except by trying to fight off the enemy. An axe was standing right in my line of fire. I tried to help him get down behind a rock. Then I turned to Mikey, who was obviously badly hurt now. "Can you move, buddy?" I asked him. And he groped in his pocket for his mobile phone, the one we had dared not use because it would betray our position. And then Lieutenant Murphy walked out into the open ground. He walked until he was more or less in the center, gunfire all around him, and he sat on a small rock and began punching in the numbers to HQ. I could hear him talking.
"My men are taking heavy fire. We're getting picked apart. My guys are dying out here. We need help."
And right then, Mikey took a bullet straight in the back. I saw the blood spurt from his chest. He slumped forward, dropping his phone and his rifle. But then he braced himself, grabbed them both, sat upright again, and once more put the phone to his ear.
I heard him speak again.
Roger that, sir. Thank you.
Then he stood up and staggered out to our bad position, the one guarding our left, and Mikey just started fighting again, firing at the enemy. He was hitting them, too, having made that one last, desperate call to base, the one that might yet save us if they could send help in time before we were overwhelmed. Only I knew what Mikey had done. He'd understood we had only one realistic chance, and that was to call in help. He also knew there was only one place from which he could possibly make that cell phone work, out in the open, away from the cliff walls. Knowing the risk, understanding the danger, in the full knowledge the phone call could cost him his life, Lieutenant Michael Patrick Murphy, son of Maureen, fiancé of the beautiful Heather, walked out into the firestorm. His objective was clear, to make one last valiant attempt to save his two teammates. He made the call, made the connection. He reported our approximate position, the strength of our enemy, and how serious the situation was. When they shot him, I thought mortally. He kept talking.
Roger that, sir. Thank you.
Will those words ever dim in my memory, even if I live to be 100? Will I ever forget them? Would you? And was there ever a greater SEAL team commander, an officer who fought to the last, and as perhaps his dying move, risked everything to save his remaining men? I doubt there was ever anyone better than Mikey, cool under fire, always thinking, fearless about issuing the one option command, even if it was nearly impossible. And then, the final, utterly heroic act, not a gesture, an act of supreme valor. Lieutenant Mikey was a wonderful person and a very, very great SEAL officer. If they build a memorial to him as high as the Empire State Building, it won't ever be high enough for me. Mikey was still alive, and he carried on, holding the left. I stayed on the right, both of us firing carefully and accurately. I was still trying to reach slightly higher ground, but the depleted army of the Taliban was determined that I should not get it, and every time I tried to advance even a few yards, get even a few feet higher, they drove me back. Mikey, too, was still trying to climb higher, and he actually made it some of the way, into a rock strata above where I was standing. It was a good spot from which to attack, but defensively poor, and I knew this must surely be Mikey's last stand. Just then, Axe walked right by me in a kind of a daze, making only a marginal attempt at staying in the cover of the rocks. Then I saw the wound, the right side of his head almost blown away. I shouted, "Axe! Axe! Come on, old buddy! Get down there! Right down there!" I was pointing at the one spot in the rocks we might find protection, and he tried to raise his hand, an act of confirmation that he'd heard me. But he couldn't. And he kept walking, slowly, hunched forward, no longer clutching his rifle. He was down to just his pistol, but I knew he could not hold that aim and fire. At least he was headed for cover, even though no one could survive a head wound like that. I knew Axe was dying. Mikey was still firing, but suddenly I heard him scream my name, the most bone-chilling, primeval scream.
"Help me, Marcus! Please, help me!"
He was my best friend in all the world, but he was 30 yards up the mountain, and I could not climb to him. I could hardly walk. And if I'd moved 2 yards out of my protected position, they would have hit me with 100 bullets. Nonetheless, I edged out around the rocks to try to give him covering fire, to force these bastards back, give him a breather until I could find a way to get up there without getting mowed down. And all the time, he was screaming, calling out my name, begging me to help him live. And there was nothing I could do except die with him. Even then, with only a couple of magazines left, I still believed I could nail these fuckers in the turbans and somehow save him and Axe. I just wanted Mikey to stop screaming, for his agony to end. But every few seconds, he cried out for me again. And every time it happened, I felt like I'd been stabbed. There were tears welling uncontrollably out of my eyes, not for the first time on this day. I would have done anything for Mikey. I'd have laid down my own life for him. But my death, right here, in this outcrop of rocks, was not going to save him. If I could save him, it would be by staying alive. And then, as suddenly as it began, the screaming stopped. There was silence for a few seconds, as if even these Taliban warriors understood that Mikey had died. I moved slightly forward and looked up there in time to see four of them come down and fire several rounds into his fallen body. The screaming had stopped for everyone except me. I still hear Mikey. Every night, I still hear that scream above all other things, even above the death of Danny Dietz. For several weeks, I thought I might be losing my mind because I could never push it aside. There were one or two frightening occasions when I heard it in broad daylight and found myself pressed against a wall, my hands covering my ears. I always thought these kinds of psychiatric problems were suffered by other people, ordinary people, not by Navy SEALs. I now know the reality of them. I also doubt whether I will ever sleep through the night again. Danny was dead. Mikey was now dead. And Axe was dying. Right now, there were two of us, but only just. I resolved to walk down to where Axe was hiding and to die there with him. There was, I knew, unlikely to be a way out. There were still maybe 50 of the enemy, perhaps by now hunting only me. It took me nearly 10 minutes, firing back behind me sporadically to try to pin them down, just in case. I was firing on the wild chance that there was a shot at survival, that somehow Mikey's phone call might yet have the guys up here in time for a last-ditch rescue. When I reached Axe, he was sitting in a hollow, and he'd fixed a temporary bandage on the side of his head. I stared at him, wondering where those cool blue eyes of his had gone, the eyes in which I could now see my own reflection. Were blood black, the sockets filled from the terrible wound in his skull. I smiled at him because I knew we would not walk this way again, at least not together, not on this earth. Axe did not have long. If he'd been in the finest hospital in North America, Axe would still not have had long. The life was ebbing out of him. And I could see this powerful super athlete growing weaker by the second. "Hey, man," I said, "you're all fucked up." And I tried pitifully to fix the bandage.
"Marcus, they got us good, man."
He spoke with difficulty, as if trying to concentrate. And then he said,
"You stay alive, Marcus, and tell Cindy I love her."
Those were his last words. I just sat there, And that was where I planned to stay, right there with Axe, so he wouldn't be alone when the end came. I didn't give a flying fuck what happened to me anymore. Quietly, I made my peace with God, and I thanked him for protecting me and saving my rifle, which somehow I still had. I never took my eyes off Axe, who was semi-conscious, but still breathing. Along with the other two, Axe will always be a hero to me. Throughout this brief but brutal conflict, he'd fought like a wounded tiger, like Audie Murphy, like Sergeant York. They shot away his body, crippled his brain, but not his spirit. They never got that. Matthew Jean Axelson, husband of Cindy, fired at the enemy until he could no longer hold his rifle. He was just past his 29th birthday. And in his dying moments, I never took my eyes off him. I don't think he could hear me any longer, but his eyes were open and we were still together. And I refused to allow him to die alone. Right then, they must have seen us, because one of those super powerful Russian grenades came in, landed close, and blew me sideways, right out of the hollow, across the rough ground, and over the edge of the goddamned ravine. I lost consciousness before I hit the bottom, and when I came to, I was in a different hollow. And my first thought was I'd been blinded by the explosion, because I couldn't see a thing. However, after a few seconds, I gathered my wits and realized I was upside down in the freaking hole. I still had my eyesight and a few other working parts, but my left leg seemed paralyzed, and to a lesser degree, so was my right. It took me God knows how long to wriggle out onto flat ground and claw my way into the cover of a rock. My ears were zinging, I guess from the blast of the grenade. I looked up and saw I had fallen a pretty good way down, but I was too disoriented to put a number on it. The main difference between now and when I'd been sitting with Axe was that the gunfire had ceased. If they'd reached Axe, who could not possibly have lived through the blast, they might not have bothered to go on shooting. They obviously had not found me, and I would have been real hard to locate upside down in the hole. But whatever, no one seemed to be looking. For the first time in maybe an hour and a half, I was apparently not being actively hunted. Aside from being unable to stand, I had two other very serious problems. The first was the total loss of my pants. They'd been blown right off me. The second was the condition of my left leg, which I could scarcely feel, but which was a horrific sight, bleeding profusely and full of shrapnel. I had no bandages, nothing medical. I had been able to do nothing for my teammates, and I could do nothing for myself, except try to stay hidden. It was not a promising situation. I was damn sure I'd broken my back and probably my shoulder. I'd broken my nose, and my face was a total mess. I couldn't stand up, never mind walk. At least one leg was wrecked, and maybe the other. I was paralyzed in both thighs, and the only way I could move was to belly crawl. Unsurprisingly, I was dazed. And through this personal fog of war, there was yet one more miracle for me to recognize. Not 2 feet from where I was lying, half hidden by dirt and shale, well out of sight of my enemy, was my Mark 12 rifle, and I still had 1.5 magazines left. I prayed before I grabbed it, because I thought it might be just a mirage, and that when I tried to hold it, well, it might just disappear. But it did not. And I felt the cold steel in the hot air as my fingers clasped it.
I listened again for his voice. I prayed again, imploring him for guidance. But there was no sound, and all I knew was that somehow I had to make it out to the right, where I'd be safe, at least for a while. My God had not spoken again, but neither had he forsaken me. I knew that. For damned sure, I knew that. I knew one other thing as well. For the first time, I was entirely alone. Here in these Taliban-controlled hostile mountains, there was no earthly teammate for me, and my enemy was all around. Had they heeded the words of the goat herds, that there were four of us, and that right now they had only three bodies? Or did they assume I had been blown to pieces by the blast of the final Russian RPG? I had no answer to those questions. Only hope. With absolutely no one to turn to, no Mikey, no Axe, no Danny. I had to face the final battle by myself, maybe lonely, maybe desolate, maybe against formidable odds. But I was not giving up. I had only one teammate, and he moved, as ever, in mysterious ways. But I was a Christian, and he had somehow saved me from 1,000 AK-47 bullets on this day. No one had shot me, which was well nigh beyond all comprehension. And I still believed he did not wish me to die, and I would still try my best to uphold the honor of the United States Navy SEALs as I imagined they would have wished. No surrender. Fuck that. When I judged I had fully gathered my senses and checked my watch, it was exactly 13:42 local time. For a few minutes, there was no gunfire, and I was beginning to assume they thought I was dead. Wrong, Marcus. The Taliban AKs opened up again, and suddenly there were bullets flying everywhere, all around, just like before. My enemy was coming up on me from the lower levels and from both sides, firing rapidly but inaccurately. Their bullets were ripping into the earth and shale across a wide range, most of them, thank Christ, well away from me. It was clear they thought I might be still alive, but equally clear, they had not yet located me. They were conducting a kind of recon by fire, trying to flush me out, blazing away right across the spectrum, hoping someone would finally hit me and finish me. Or better yet, that I would come out with my hands high so the murdering little bastards could cut my head off or indulge in one of their other attractive little idiosyncrasies before telling that evil little television station Al Jazeera how they had conquered the infidels. I think I've mentioned my view about surrender. I rammed another magazine into the breech of my miraculous rifle and somehow crawled over this little hill, through the hail of bullets, right into the side of the mountain. No one saw me. No one hit me. I wedged myself into a rocky crevasse with my legs sticking out into a clump of bushes. There were huge rocks to both sides protecting me. Overall, I judged I was jammed into a 15-foot-wide ledge on the mountain. It was not a cave, not even a shallow cave, because it had a kind of open top way above me. Rocks and sand kept falling down on me as the Taliban warriors scrambled around above my position. But this crevasse provided sensational cover and camouflage. Even I realized I would be pretty hard to spot. They'd have to get real lucky, even with their latest policy of trying to flush me out with sheer volume of fire. My line of vision was directly ahead. I realized I couldn't move or change position, at least in broad daylight I couldn't, and it was imperative I hide the blood which was leaking from my battered body. I took stock of my injuries. My left leg was still bleeding pretty bad, and I packed the wounds with mud. I had a big cut on my forehead, which I also packed with mud. Both legs were numb. I was not going anywhere. At least, not for a while. I had no medical kit, no maps, no compass. I had my bullets, and I had my gun. And I had a decent view off my mountain, straight ahead over the canyon to the next mountain. I had no pants, and no buddies, but no one could see me. I was wedged in tight, my back to the wall, in every possible sense. I eased myself into a relatively comfortable position, checked my rifle, and laid it down the length of my body, aiming outward. If enough of them discovered me, I guess I'd quickly be going to join Danny, Axe, and Mikey. But not before I'd killed a whole lot more of them. I was, I knew, in a perfect position for a stubborn, defensive military action, protected on all sides, vulnerable to a frontal assault only, and that would have to be by weight of numbers.